Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the myth-busting ancient history podcast that aims to separate historical fact from mythical fiction. Once more, unto the breech berth we go as we delve into the world of women's health. Yes, indeed, this episode is focused on childbirth. We're joined by Xenia, who gives mistruths about ancient Rome a wide berth, Meg, who gives lies about the ancient Greeks a born ultimatum, Barney, who delivers the truth about the ancient Near East, and our firm friend Caroline Lawrence, apotropaic heroine and author of the Roman Mysteries novels for kids. I'm Flo, and I'm not an expert in the ancient world, but I'm becoming rapidly familiar with the world of childbirth. In fact, I've decided to complete my own research into the field, and if you listen to the following sounds, you'll hear the heartbeat of my own baby as I wait to be induced. Just a little note before we begin, listeners. Meg wasn't able to make this recording due to a totally non-Zeus-related storm knocking out her internet. So she's given a few messages to a kindly stork who's going to be delivering them throughout the podcast. So we're coming up now to the push, and actually, for me, might be within the next couple of weeks. And I'm looking forward to giving birth. Not sure how I'm going to do it yet, whether it's the traditional way or if I'm having a cesarean, but there's a little bit of trepidation involved. Now, worldwide at the moment, if you take every single country into account, the mortality rate for mothers is less than 1%. Nowadays, in most countries, it is less than 0.1%. But I have the idea that that's probably not the case in the ancient world. I have the idea that maybe mortality rates were a little bit higher for mum and baby in the ancient world. Is that true?
We don't have statistics, but I'm sure it's true. Yeah, absolutely. They say that the two most dangerous times in your life are when you're born in the ancient world and if you're a woman giving birth.
Very, very risky. And you've spoken in a previous episode about just how sometimes unclean things were for people. So even taking germs into account, you've maybe not got the most sanitary place to give birth. And of course, there's so many things that can go wrong with birth and so many bits of tech in terms of medicine and equipment that we use, even for the most easy and laid back birth, if there is such a thing, which there isn't, that the ancients wouldn't have had access to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we've got some written sources and we've got some wonderful visual sources. And one of our best visual sources for childbirth are these kind of plaques that can be either made of marble or terracotta. And they are on tombs. And they show women in some really interesting different positions for childbirth, all detailed by the Roman gynecologist or the Roman medic, Serranus. And they, not necessarily tragic, they're not necessarily showing a woman who died in childbirth, because we know that at least one of them is Scribonia Atticae. From Ostia, where the books I write are set, and she's got a plaque on her tomb saying that she was a midwife, and it shows her in one of the positions. And if you like, I can quickly take you through what you needed before the whole childbirth process takes place. There is a wonderful summary in one verse from Ezekiel in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Tanakh, which sums up what the midwife did when a baby was born. And it's God saying to Israel, "On the day you were born, your cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water to make you clean, nor were you rubbed with salt or wrapped in cloths." And that is a kind of summary of exactly what happens after the baby's born. But before the baby's born, Serranus says you need to get everything ready. You need to get oil and cloths and things to smell, presumably to revive the mother if she faints. And she ideally needs three helpers, one of whom is the midwife, and the others probably would have been the midwife's assistants are family members or just women in the town or the village. And you also need a hard couch, a soft couch, and ideally a birthing stool. And what you do is when the woman starts to come into labor, she lies on the hard couch with her hips slightly elevated and one of the women on either side gently massaging her belly with oil, scented oil, nice olive oil that's not been used for cooking. And the midwife will wait and she'll grease her hand and get up in there and make sure the baby's in the right position, that the cervix is dilated. Before the baby's born, when the woman's almost ready to give birth, she's then taken from the hard couch onto the birthing stool. And this is the mosaic, the plaque from Ostia shows the midwife sitting in front of the woman on the birthing stool with a woman behind her holding her under her arms. And the birthing stool was quite low. It had a hole in it in the bottom, a bit like a privy or something. No front, no back, but sides, and something to grip onto. The woman could grip onto the arms, and press her back against the back as well. When the baby pops out, hopefully, the cord is cut either with a blade or they recommend often thread to cut the cord. And then the baby is rubbed with salt and cleaned, washed off with water, put on a cushion. The afterbirth has to come out, and then the woman is moved to a soft couch where she can recover. And I was once asked by someone in the Ostia Antica, a kind of Facebook group, a woman studying childbirth, if I would be able to go to the Wellcome Institute storage facility in Blythe House in West Kensington and look at a plaque, a marble plaque from a tomb that shows a woman reclining on a bed, and there are three women with her. One has a baby on a cushion. The other one is just delivering the afterbirth, and the third one is holding back a cloth, and I can put that on my Twitter feed. So we've got some wonderful illustrations. Now that would be an ideal birth, and that's when everything goes well. And then what you finally do is you wrap the baby in swaddling clothes, wrap him up tight, and that does calm a fractious baby often, and you put him on the ground. And if he cries, that means he's worth rearing. He or she is worth rearing. Obviously, boy babies are more desirable. And in Roman times, you would put the baby on the ground in front of the father. He would look at the baby. If he thought it was his, he would take it and put it on his knee. The word for knee in Latin is genu, G-E-N-U. And that showed he was genuine. And that's where we get the word genuine.
Whoa.
So that's a very quick summary of the childbirth process at its most ideal.
So I don't want to sound too ridiculous, but actually that sounds far more advanced and sensible than I would have given the ancients credit for. I thought, oh, rubbing the baby in salt's a bit odd. And then I remembered actually babies are covered in a sort of mucus called vernix, aren't they? This white mucus. So they're taking that away.
Exactly. Serena suggests mixing the salt with oil or some honey or something, and very fine salt or natron, which is a kind of alkali thing. And you rub him with salt, just as it says in Ezekiel, which is fascinating because, you know, that's like 600 BC or something. And we've got Serenus 100 AD. So you've got a 700-year gap, but they're doing the same thing. They're rubbing the baby with salt, washing him off, either with wine, which was also an antiseptic, though they didn't know it, but they knew it worked, or just warm water, and then you wrap him in swaddling clothes. And what's really fascinating is that I'm convinced that women who were poor, who relied on just the village women, probably had a much better result than when male surgeons came bustling in and tried to help. So it was much safer for just the women to pitch in and do this, and a midwife who would be trained and would be experienced and would probably pass down from mother to daughter or father to daughter.
That's still true today. In countries where childbirth is midwife led rather than obstetrician led, mother and baby mortality rates are actually lower. So it is still true today that midwives or midwife-led care is more successful.
Absolutely, absolutely. And having just the friends, your family supporting you, physically supporting you and soothing you, mopping your brow, stroking your hair. It's hard to imagine Pliny or Galen doing that, really. Sorry, one of those male, I'm sure there were sympathetic male doctors. Yeah, absolutely.
Childbirth was seen as dangerous for almost everyone involved, according to the Greeks. It's obviously a time of immense danger for the mother and for the baby, and this is quite openly acknowledged. So Greek women would dedicate jewellery and clothing to goddesses associated with birth to pray for a safe birth. Aristotle talks about high proportions of babies who die during the birth or in the first couple of days afterwards, and we do have gravestones which have sort of engravings of women dying in childbirth or shortly afterwards. But childbirth also releases pollution or miasma, or at least the Greeks think it does. And I think I spoke about this in the last episode, but I just thought I'd read you something I found on this pollution, which really demonstrates how dangerous it was seen as being for sort of everyone involved in the birth. This is from Cyrene, which is actually the home of the abortion plant that we spoke about a couple of episodes ago. And it says, "The woman who has just given birth pollutes the house. She pollutes anyone inside the house, but she does not pollute anyone outside the house unless he comes inside. The person who is inside shall be polluted for 3 days, but he will not pollute anyone else, no matter where this person goes." And I thought that was interesting in terms of how they thought about childbirth and this release of sort of pollution or miasma and the idea that childbirth was messy and violent and bloody. But also, I just think that sounds exactly like the COVID rules. Like, you can't come inside the house or you'll get infected. And then if you go inside the house, you'll be polluted for 3 days and you have to wait for that pollution to go away. So that also I thought was interesting.
I forgot to say that the midwife has to take her little finger, and midwives are always encouraged to have their fingernails cut short except for one that they might need to tear the sac, the amniotic sac. But with her little finger, she would clear the baby's nose and mouth and ears, and also his little bottom, to make sure there are no obstructions there, with olive oil on her hands. And her hands would be washed. I think they do talk about washing their hands first.
The oil is interesting that you mentioned as well, because was that applied to the mother?
Yes, everywhere. It's a lubricant. It's I believe it's antiseptic as well. And of course, you can warm oil, and sometimes they had bladders full of warm oil to put on either side of the belly to just warm it and soothe it.
Sounds very pleasant.
Gosh, it sounds so nice. It's funny because I'm doing a hypnobirthing course at the moment, and everything that the course has said to do in terms of, you know, being in a nice calm birth environment with people that you know, having smells and sensations around you that are pleasant, like the massage or like the oil, like nice smelling things, is exactly what the hypnobirthing course says to do. And it's like, oh wow, the Romans knew. They knew how to make it nice.
The room was supposed to be dim as well. You know, you don't want bright light, so you want it
perfect,
dim, quiet room, and not too hot, not too cold. So yeah, it does sound nice for what was probably the most terrifying thing a woman ever had to face in her life.
I was going to say, I could probably contrast that with an incantation from the ancient Near East.
Oh, go on then, Bonnie.
That really captures the terror of giving birth, I would say. But it's quite impressive too. So I hope you don't mind if I read this extract out. The Assyrian incantation to be read out for a good pregnancy and birth goes like this. The mother is enveloped in the dust of death, like a chariot enveloped in the dust of battle, like a plough enveloped in the dust of the woods. Like a warrior in the fray, she is cast down in her blood. She wears no veil and has no shame. Now the battle is on. I'm surrounded. Reach me. Bring forth that sealed up one, a creation of the gods, a creation of man. Let him come out to see the light.
I think that's really empowering. I know it sounds like the dust of death is quite intimidating, but I've been on a labour ward in and out with preeclampsia over the past couple of weeks, and I've heard now I think 5 or 6 babies being born, and the battle cry that comes from women who are giving birth is amazing. It's really moving and powerful.
Perhaps you can keep a recording of it to play during your own delivery.
I will go, ha, look how strong I am.
That's so interesting that you describe it as a battle cry, Flo. And Barney, that incantation was amazing. I think that's so incredible. And the Greeks definitely did think that childbirth was a sort of battle. It was definitely conceptualized in that way. There's a really famous line from Euripides' Medea, which is a 5th century BC tragedy, where Medea, the sort of tragic heroine, says, "They say we have a peaceful life at home, while they go to battle with spears, but they think wrong. I would rather stand armed with a shield 3 times than give birth once." Which is a very powerful and moving thing to say, I think. She does then murder her children, so we can take that with a pinch of salt. But there are other associations between childbirth and sort of warfare. Dying for your city as a man in a battle in ancient Greece is seen as basically the height of achievement. And the female equivalent of that for the Greeks is childbirth. And Plutarch, who's a writer from the 1st century AD, and okay, again, pinch of salt. I need a sound for pinch of salt, I think. Plutarch says that in Sparta, there were only 2 types of death that would be commemorated with grave inscriptions, and that would be dying in battle or dying in childbirth. So there's definitely a link there.
I'm going to skip back really briefly just to talk about the positions in the Roman birthing scenarios, because quite often on TV and film, at least, we see women in the Western world giving birth on their backs with their feet up in stirrups. If they're giving birth vaginally or traditionally, now that isn't necessarily the best way that our bodies are built to give birth. We're not using gravity there to let baby's head drop down. And I've heard a rumour that it's from the sort of Middle Ages in Europe, when rich men wanted to see their heirs being born. They wanted a sort of a front row seat to be able to see whether or not they were having a son or a daughter, and to ensure that the baby coming out was, you know, was theirs.
I can debunk that right now before you go any further. Serenus, and I quote, this is written 100 AD. "During labor, the parturient, the woman giving birth, lay on her back on a hard low bed with support under her hips. Her feet were drawn up together, her thighs parted."
Oh, so it's actually much older. I remember at primary school, a little boy in my class, who shall remain nameless, just on the off chance he's listening, very proudly told us during sex education that he was born on the toilet, and then came back to school the next day to clarify that he'd actually been born on a birthing chair that had a hole in it.
Well, as I said, that's the sequence is the woman lies on the hard couch on her back with her feet together, which I'm not quite sure how that worked. Her feet were drawn up together. If it's kind of like, I don't know, a kind of cobbler's pose from yoga with your feet together, yeah, and your knees out, I guess. but we have this again from these ancient plaques, a relief of these. And then she's moved to the birthing stool right before the baby comes. And then she's moved back to the soft couch. So it definitely predates the medieval.
I have some information about the birthing positions from the ancient Near East, actually, if anybody wanted that. For comparison. I actually think it's a position and a method of delivery that's been associated with the East for thousands of years, which is on bricks, raised off the ground, on sort of a stack of bricks on each side.
Sounds comfortable.
So are you on all fours, or are you on your back, or are
you sort of squatting on, crouching and squatting on two bricks or 2 stacks of bricks?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
What, your feet are on the bricks, not your thighs?
Knees on the bricks. Ooh. Hands
knees
on
the bricks.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah, I think the instrumental thing is the raising off of the ground, actually. But the bricks also took on a symbolic role, especially in Egypt, where they have these magical bricks in tombs, which are smaller inscribed bricks not to be squatted on. And they were associated with rebirth in that instance. So the brick itself, whilst it's sort of, you know, it's maybe like a precursor to a birthing stool or something like that, also there were literal sort of magical bricks associated with the process. So if someone's giving birth and you bring the bricks, I think it's mentioned in the Bible as well, in Exodus, when Moses is being born.
Oh, that's fascinating. Because the midwife probably had her kit, her kind of doctor's bag or whatever, and she may have actually owned her own birthing chair or birthing stool, and taken that wherever she went. So that's a bit like bringing the bricks, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's the idea. Yeah, the bricks or the stones of birth.
Are the bricks sort of partly symbolic, but also partly, because mentally in my head, it's almost like the midwife becomes a car mechanic and mum is lifted up like a Vauxhall Vectra, so that midwife can take a look underneath and see what's going on.
Let's see what's under the hood.
Yeah, that mentally, that's what my brain is saying, that actually it's for leverage to see what's happening with the neck of the womb or with the cervix, because I can't work out why on earth. I don't think anybody could persuade me, even I'm not in labor right now, but I'm very pregnant. I don't think anyone could persuade me to get up on some bricks at the moment.
I think the height allows you to sort of receive the baby as it comes out, without it touching onto any surface. So it just goes straight into somebody's arms.
You know, I wrote some books called The Roman Mysteries, and the final book that they did a TV series of them about 15 years ago. And the final episode was one where a 14-year-old girl gives birth. It was filmed in Bulgaria, and they made a brilliant birthing chair, replica birthing chair. And the actress, Natasha Barrero, said it was the most uncomfortable thing she'd ever sat on. And she obviously wasn't pregnant or anything. So I'm not sure if they made it right. But
gosh, that's sort of like inadvertent experimental archaeology there, isn't it?
Exactly. But and it's kind of, it's almost a precursor to the modern toilet in a way, because it's the same principle. It's you sit, but there's a hole there for stuff to come out. And
so maybe that little boy in my primary school class wasn't entirely wrong when he said he was born on a toilet.
Exactly.
Okay. I shouldn't have judged. So I'm definitely going more towards the ancient Roman method of giving birth. It sounds actually very, very dignified and quite relaxing. So we had midwives in ancient Rome.
In terms of medical professionals being involved in ancient Greek childbirth, midwives are seen as very important. A little fun fact for you is that Socrates' mother was a midwife, and Socrates uses midwifery as a metaphor for other types of guiding or helping things come to fruition. So there's almost this concept of a midwifery of ideas, like, you know, giving birth to a thought. So that's just a little tidbit. I thought I'd give a shout out to a particular midwife, who's an Athenian woman called Phanastrate. And on her tombstone, there's an engraving of her holding hands with the mother that she looked after. And there are children all around her, which is really, really sweet. And it says on the tombstone that she was a midwife and physician, a trouble to no one, but missed by everyone in her death. So that's a kind of nice way of showing how important midwives were. In terms of sort of doctors, the Hippocratic Corpus has a go at describing some childbirth issues. So the Hippocratic Corpus, we've spoken about a lot, is a really important collection of Greek medical texts associated with Hippocrates. And the Hippocratic Corpus says, if for a long time the woman is not delivered of the child, generally the child is coming out sideways or feet first, whereas it should come out head first. This is how the disorder comes about. It is just as if someone dropped an olive pit into an oil flask with a small mouth. The pit naturally can't be taken out when it is turned on its side. In the same way, the presentation of the embryo when it is sideways is difficult for the woman, for it doesn't come out. Difficult also is the situation where it is leaving feet first. Oftentimes the women die, or the children, or even both. So that's a sort of description of different ways that children can actually be sort of positioned within the womb, which is interesting. And there's a passage in the Hippocratic Corpus about whether or not women know their own health better than male doctors, which I just thought was super interesting. So it says, "You must not refuse to believe women on the subject of childbearing, for they always say the same thing and say what they know. They would not be persuaded either by act or judgment of anything that is contrary to what they know about what is happening in their own bodies. It is possible for those who wish to say something different, but women who form a judgment and argue convincingly will always say and claim, for example, that they give birth to 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 month babies, and of these, the 8 month ones do not survive. And they claim that the majority of miscarriages occur in the first 40 days. So that 8 month, 10 month thing seems a bit suspect, but the majority of miscarriages thing seems quite legit to me. But I just thought that was a really interesting passage. They're sort of saying, you know, women do know their own bodies and they will try and tell you what's happening, and they might be right and you should probably listen, but also, you know, you can try and tell them otherwise if you wish. So yeah, there we go. There's some doctors and midwives.
So I've got a misconception that I've stumbled across in the past, and I think it's worth revisiting. So I don't know whether or not I'm going to give birth vaginally or if I'm going to give birth cesarean at this point in time. Now, there was a whole thing that at school for me that cesareans are named after Julius Caesar, and that is against the law.
Yep, you can bang the gavel on that one.
But also, I'm not sure if cesareans were feasible in the ancient world, because it's a huge procedure. And in fact, I've learnt something which I wish I didn't know about cesareans, but I've learnt it, so you all have to as well. There is an element where when a woman's organs are moved out of the way during a cesarean section, they might be pulled to one side, or they may be sort of dislodged and taken out of the body cavity. And then once baby is delivered, instead of putting things back where they live, the organs are sort of put back into place. And over the next couple of days after the cesarean, as you're healing, you can feel your organs move and shift back into the place that they're supposed to be, which I find really alarming and a little bit old fashioned. It's just dropping things back where they were and hoping that they'll shift back into the right place, which I'm sure is fine since cesareans are performed very regularly, but it seems very jarring.
I think in Roman times, a cesarean was only done when the mother was going to die and she couldn't give birth, and they wanted to save the baby, but they did not expect to save the mother. And if Julius Caesar's name, Caesar, I believe comes from the root of cut, it was would have been one of his ancestors who had been brought out of the mother who must have died. And the baby was then given to a wet nurse to raise. So I think most cesareans, you only do them when the mother is going to die and you just have to save the baby.
So it's only done if mum is dead or dying. And that's a sort
I think
of
so, because I can't imagine many women surviving a cesarean if you think how complicated it is and how many opportunities there are for infection and everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm exhausted just thinking about the prospect of giving birth in the ancient world, let alone in real life. Do we have any apotropaic facts or comforting things that might have been available to...
Many apotropaic things. And one of the most famous is from the apocryphal book of Tobit from the kind of Old Testament. It's a story about a young man who wants to get married, but a demon keeps killing the suitors of this young woman. So they put all sorts of smelly fish gall and stuff. They burn fish gall and the smell will keep away any demons. Also, I've heard that in the Middle East, there are dances with knives that the midwives can do around the birthing chamber before the woman in labor is brought in. Knots. You cannot have knots anywhere in the room, because a knot, and I believe this is in Rome and Greece as well as the Middle East, a knot will cause the baby by sympathetic magic to stay knotted up in the womb. So you want to untie every knot in the room so that the baby is free to come out. And I think that might tie in with some of those amulets we have that keep the womb closed to a certain point, and then until it's time to unlock the womb.
Oh, what's this amulet?
Well, they're womb amulets. They're made of bloodstone, which again is a sympathetic, semi-precious stone. It's the color of blood, and they show the womb. Now, the womb is shown as a kind of a round bottom cup, and if you turn it upside down, a womb looks like that, or it sometimes looks like a little animal with two ears and a kind of pointy bit at the bottom. And the two ears are where it attaches, I guess, to the fallopian tubes. I guess they've done some autopsies. So, and underneath the womb is carved onto this gemstone, and underneath is a key with seven, which is a magical number, seven tines, and often an inscription, either a nonsense inscription or something like even a Hebrew word like abracadabra, which is Aramaic for I say as I do, or may it be created as I say. So these are believed to keep the womb sealed until the time of birth is ready.
Wow, okay.
Actually, I've got some really good, interesting similarities then with all of that. Conceptually, specific words you were using there, Caroline, come up a lot in these ancient Near Eastern incantations. They're also interested in knots and knotting and locks and unlocking. Although I don't get the impression that the knot was necessarily a dangerous thing to have around, rather something to be sort of undone to allow the baby to get out. But an old Babylonian incantation that I found, if I could be permitted to read another few lines out, and everybody has the patience for that, you might find some bits that you like in there as well, which goes, "In the waters of intercourse, the bone was created. In the flesh of muscles, the baby was created. In the ocean waters, fearsome, raging, in the far-off waters of the sea, where the little one is, their arms bound. Opened are the paths for you. You are released. Removed are the locks, the doors thrown aside. Bring yourself out."
Oh, that's so sweet.
My baby kicked all the way through that incantation.
It worked. Removed are the locks.
And of course, the word religion comes from the root of to tie up. When you bind something, you bind yourself to a god or a demon, or you cut the bond, you know. So that whole, a vow will bind you to the god or the demigod to whom you're praying. So the idea of binding is very deeply ingrained.
Powerful.
I really like that. I might have, so when I give my plan to the hospital, I'm going to say, "Midwives only, please, no doctors. I want some salt to scrub the baby with, and I want someone to read this incantation out for me." I think that's really sweet. I like that a lot. I think as a podcast, we're nearly 10 centimetres dilated, so it might be time for us to wrap up proceedings and think about what our favourite thing to learn today has been. So I'm going to always go with our guest, Caroline. If you would like to share your favourite thing that we've talked about today or favourite thing that you've learned, what springs to mind for you?
Well, I always love Barney's incantations, and I love the one about the woman who's like a rider on a chariot going into battle, I think. And in fact, that was an attitude that this was woman's warfare. I think especially in Sparta, that a woman's courage was shown on the birthing couch or in the birthing chair. Barney, was that Akkadian, did you say?
Yes, that was Akkadian, yeah. It was an Assyrian incantation, that one.
Right. Thank you. Brilliant. Loved it.
It was really good. I find it really empowering, and I actually thought the plea to the baby to come out was actually really sweet as well. Yeah, I think I'll get someone to read those out as I'm pushing, I think. That's definitely probably not the weirdest request that anyone's ever had in a birthing suite. So Barney, since you brought the incantations, what was your favourite thing from today?
Baby salt scrub.
Yeah, baby exfoliants.
Yeah, I really like that. I've never heard that before. The oils were familiar, and so many of the other things, like the sort of calming atmosphere, but the salt scrub is new to me, and I like it.
It is new to me, and actually I thought it was quite nice that, you know, we're considering, you know, baby's first skincare routine as well. It's very nice. So Xenia, you and I are looking at a future of possibly planning our our own births. Is there anything that's grabbed you from today that you might be stealing for your birth plan?
Well, I think what I'm going to take away is that very nice sounding oil massage while you're in labour. That sounds great. That sounds super relaxing. And I'm gonna try and be in that situation.
Nice and calm and relaxed with your oils and your scents.
Yeah.
get in the right headspace.
Get on my birth ball, bounce up and down a bit.
I think if I can take it in a completely different direction, my favourite thing to learn today was Mum on Bricks. I thought that was quite bizarre. I don't know if I will be adopting that as part of my own birthing plan, but the concept of being up on those bricks is, I might bring some bricks in just in case, you know, I've got a labour go bag with me at all times. So I might see if I need to incorporate some bricks in there as well.
Maybe you could take Jenga or something for it, for magical properties.
Yeah, magical birthing Jenga. Again, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure doulas and midwives and obstetricians have heard stranger things. So, you know, I don't think anyone would bat an eye, really, if I suggested bringing that. Or my own birthing stool.
When Caroline was mentioning the incantations there, almost like a little homework task came to mind for listeners of the podcast, to go and compare the words of those ancient Near Eastern incantations with the lyrics of Kate Bush's song, This Woman's Work, which I think is about childbirth as well.
Oh, I like it.
Okay, well, that's some homework for you guys, and you can join us next time on Against the Law.